For more than 40 years, my guest Alwyn Nicolai has been considered a revolutionary force in the dance world. He describes his dance theater as an experience of movement, shape, sound, and color. Dancer Murray Lewis, who performed with the Nicolai Troupe for 20 years, refers to Nicolai as the only genius I've ever known. He took the theater art, which became fractioned into painting, music, dance, and poetry, and pulled the pieces together to make a 20th century theater art, a theater art of abstraction. Nicolai conceptualizes all the elements himself, including composing his own music. He's pioneered many new visual techniques, such as projecting his own hand-painted slides onto the dancers' bodies, using dancers' bodies as abstract shapes. This year, Nicolai was honored with the Kennedy Center Life Achievement Award. I asked Alwyn Nicolai to explain his credo that dance should be motion and not emotion.
Well, really, it came about through my trying to define dance. And I felt that there was a certain basic craft and skill to dance, similar to the painter's craft. For example, the painter's skill is the sensitivity and manipulation of color. And if he doesn't have that, he's going to be a poor painter. And of course, with music, it's the manipulation of sound. And I felt with the dancer, he should have a definition that was basic to him too, and that is the manipulation of motion. And motion, which had its own intelligence. It doesn't have to, let's say, qualify him or her or decorate the person doing it, but that within the gesture rests the intelligence of the intent.
When you were coming into your own as a choreographer, was there a lot of emotion as opposed to motion behind
yes.
the dances?
Oh, yes. Sturm und Drang, I think is what. Oh, yes. It was the expressional period, and my study period was all through that. Of course, that started with Isadora Duncan way back in the turn of the century, 1900s. And from then until and through Graham, Martha Graham, the great high priestess that is really wonderful, wonderful dancer in person, the very strong emotional qualities were usually the content of their choreographic intent. And for instance, with Martha, it was the contraction and release, which was the agony and the ecstasy, really. And we were searching out at that time the inner feelings of common man, which was not a usual thing in dance at the turn of the century. And it started with Isadora.
And you didn't like a Freudian interpretation of
dance? Oh, Freudian particularly, yes, in the latter day. It was very, very powerful. As a matter of fact, you had to be, you couldn't drag a string on stage without its being interpreted as an umbilical cord. And the three popular words in any review were fetal, phallic, and fertile. You know, these were the three things you almost always found in a dance review.
Well, dance was also very romantic, I think, in a lot of ways. A lot of dances
were about
courtship and sexuality.
I think all art is romantic. I think all, no matter you call it avant-garde, whatever it is, it's the romance of the human spirit, whatever you do.
But you moved away from the sexual courtship aspect
yes.
of the dance drama.
Yes, I did. Yes, because I felt that had been really explored about as far as we could go at this present time in history. I think Martha Graham took it beyond Freud. Where Freud left off verbally, Martha took up and explored and communicated through dance.
I think most dancers were used to having male roles and female roles, and there were certain gender preconceptions that went along with that.
Oh, yes.
Was it hard for you to break your dancers of those ideas of what male and female dancers
did? But I had to do
that.
You see, what was interesting to me, too, and I think it's a very valid thing, because at that time, you know, sex was, as an exploration, was very dominant, but persons as such were not. In other words, I didn't want to look at a male or a female sexually. I wanted to look at them as people, as persons. I didn't feel I wanted to see them always in a state of, if I can be vulgar, a state of heat, you know. I wanted to look at them and see that they had other desires in life than sexual ones. And so that I was anti-Freudian in that respect.
Well, to describe this, frequently your dancers are dressed in exactly the same costumes.
Oh, yes.
Like a stretch fabric bodysuit.
Yes.
And you sometimes use dancers interchangeably. I've seen dancers danced one time with a male in the role and another time with a female in
the role. Yes, there are many dances that can be done either by the male or the female. I brought the polarity much closer together back in 1953. I began that. But there are still roles that I think can be done only by a woman or by a man. But the reasons I cannot explain is just that I am still uncomfortable. Now, that may be just because of historical time and, you know, psychological time at this moment. Whether or not we'll overcome that, I'm not sure.
With what you just said about wanting to get some of the sexual heat out of dance and move on to other things, I want to quote something that Murray Lewis once wrote about you in an essay. It was really about sexuality in dance.
Yes.
He said that seeing the human form revealed in tights gave you two choices. You could either think dirty or come to grips with dance as an abstraction. And he said that was a very difficult choice to make.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm wondering what it was like for you to try to get some of the kind of sexual heat out of dance at the same time you're working with young dancers and very revealing.
Who are in that, yes, are in that state. They're either in puberty or, but that's a very interesting period, you know, because of course, if they remain in that period in their 35 or 40 years, of course, then they look kind of silly anyway. But I must say, for instance, children, I can't tell you up until what age, are very comfortable with abstraction. They don't have that sense of sexuality that comes, of course, when they get into actual adolescence. And then, of course, all sorts of hell breaks loose in their minds and their bodies. But I do think that working in this manner helps them to get over it with some sanity, you know. And they can still look at themselves as growing people rather than growing sex objects, you see. I thought this was very helpful. And it was out at the Playhouse. And Murray, incidentally, was an excellent teacher of that age group because he understood that very well. And you could see that they were people and not little sex pots, you know.
You know, last night in a dance that I saw your company perform, in part of the dance, the everyone is topless, including the women.
Yes.
But when it's time to take the bows, they end up putting on bodysuits. And I thought that that was very interesting because for the dance, for the sculptural part, you wanted the body to be exposed.
Yes.
But it's a different relationship that the audience and the dancers have when the dancers are taking their bow. And for that part of the relationship, they were clothed again.
Yes. Well, there was a reason for that. The naked body takes on a luminosity in the slides that the material doesn't. And so really the purpose was not the nudity, but really the wonderful reflection that the skin tone forms as a screen for the projections.
My guest is internationally renowned choreographer Alwyn Nicolai. I'm going to quote Murray Lewis again here, and this is about the early days that he spent with your company when it was still at Henry Street.
Yes.
And he said, most of us had little in common with each other outside of our devotion to Nicolai. We were black and white, tall and short, nervous and sedated.
That's true.
Heavy and thin, wiry and phlegmatic. Now, I mean, that's an example of you choosing dancers who didn't fit any one particular mold. They were tall and short, fat, well, not fat and thin. I'm exaggerating.
Well, that was true, but, too.
Well, but I mean, you didn't...
Chubby, let's say.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's unusual for dance. You did not have this one particular mold that you wanted to find dancers to fit.
No, I still don't. I look for a quality, and as far as physicality is concerned, you don't want people who, you know, are freaks necessarily. But I think within the general range of human acceptance of the human form, I'll go along with that.
Do you think that ballet has too much idealized the body?
Not for it as an art, no, because its intent is different from mine. And I think, for instance, I loved Balanchine's idea of wanting to see the bones, and I still do like that. And I think we thought very much alike on several issues of that kind. But I think ballet is an entirely different kind of art, and that the requirements of it are different. But for modern, no. You have quality, and you know, in those early days that Murray speak about, when I was training the dancers too, they were all sizes and shapes and had different temperaments and so forth. But they were so well trained that their unison and ensemble on stage held them together. And of course, this is what it should be.
Well, you know, that brings to mind something. I think that in your company, you really emphasize ensemble performance over the solo virtuoso.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I didn't like the idea of stars. And of course, I do have solos that come out and do their thing, but they also go right back into the chorus, or not the chorus, the group. And I like to say instead, they all are stars. And I think this was my nature of thinking, too. I don't want man to single out somebody as a star, but each one has his, you know, very special heritage and quality, and I think that's a part of the American thought too, that your genes hold extraordinary information, and of course your interest in searching into them and expressing them is one of the wonderfulnesses of art.
Your dance combined sound, sculptural form, light, long before the word multimedia
was coined.
Now, you started projecting slides onto the dancers, and you've hand-colored the slides yourself.
Yes.
How did you come up with the idea of doing that? It works so well on stage. It's really quite remarkable to see.
Well, for one reason, at the Henry Street Playhouse, I had a stage. I had a beautiful little theater. It was in a remote part of town. I wasn't harassed by, by certain things that were going on. I could isolate myself and do what the hell I wanted down there. And I was searching for a new definition of dance and came to the conclusion it was the art of motion. But then I discovered that in different colored lights, the motion looked different. Also, at that time, we couldn't go naked, but I wanted to really see the whole figure. So very often, instead of having a head stick out of a costume or the hands stick out from sleeves, I colored the whole body with strong, powerful light. So you looked at a total figure rather than a costumed figure. And this was in some particular pieces. And then, of course, accidentally, let's say there might have been some streak of some kind on the light that was projected, and I saw that when they passed through that, there was a different kinetics. So I began to design designs on slides that projected on the human body made a different value of kinetics. I easily explain, for example, if you're in a room with a window with strong sunlight and you have a Venetian blind, if the blind is pulled up completely and you put your hand through it, of course you see an arm going through slides without any great kinetic effect. But the minute you drop the blind and close and make little slats of light coming, then when your arm goes through, it goes, you know, it makes a very fast kinetic action. So I began to play around with that idea, kinetics as it became tempered by the light designs cast upon the body. And this interested me a great deal.
My guest is choreographer Alwyn Nicolai. He's been a revolutionary force in the dance world for more than 40 years, pioneering the use of painting, slide projections, and poetry in dance performances. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Choreographer Alwyn Nicolai is my guest. Now, you grew up in a small New England town. Were you exposed to a lot of dance or a lot of art when you were growing up?
Oh, heavens no. There was nothing like that. We weren't in any way in the area where one saw great paintings or heard great music, no. There was music at home, and we did have a record player, one of the wind-up kind at that time. I think one was an Edison. And we did have pieces. I know my mother liked opera, and we would have some of that, but not avidly. In other words, we weren't dragged off to events for culture. But there was a professor, piano, who came in once a week and ran through the whole family. That is not the whole one, my two sisters and me, 1 hour at a time. I was usually the last, and by the time he got to me, he would fall asleep. But some way or other, I managed to learn to play the piano fast and loud. And this was my way into music. And I was then a musician first, then, you see.
Well, that's interesting because you're still a composer. You compose the music for the dances that you create. So how were you actually introduced to dance?
I first played for silent movies, organ, not piano, not hinky-dink kind of organ, but, you know, very sophisticated organ. When I was 16 years old, I started that because
it was
a depression. It was a wonderful experience for me because it lifted me right out of this small town and took me into the sophisticated areas of a city, or in this case, into the then very colorful art colony, Westport, Connecticut. And but, you know, you played for actors like Garbo and Swanson and those people in the later period because talkies hadn't quite taken over. But I learned to improvise on the organ. I improvised like a fool because I had to do it about 5 hours a day. But then, of course, talkies came in and I lost the job. And so I went back home and there, believe it or not, was a dancing school. And I went up and said, I have the skill of improvisation. Can you use me? And, of course, Gloria Stanley, the teacher, said, why, of course. And so I began to play for dance. She, in turn, took me to New Haven, to the Schubert Theater. And Mary Wigman, the great German modernist dancer, was performing. I never saw dance. I never saw anything like this. And I saw this, and I fell in love with it, and I thought, this is what I wanted to do. So I found a woman who taught, who had studied with Wigman and taught in Hartford. And so I managed to get to Hartford to study with her, and then both of us went off to Bennington College, where they had those fabulous sessions with all the great modernist teaching. Graham Humphrey, Weidman, Holm, Horst, John Martin, the early critic of the New York Times, all in a state of really wonderful, hysterical excitement about the new American art, modern dance.
When you were starting to dance, did you go through what I think a lot of young men in dance have gone through over the years, and this fear that you would be considered effeminate, you know, quote-unquote,
yes.
Because you danced?
Yeah. Yes, that sissy stuff was very prevalent, and, you know, you almost were ashamed to say you were a dancer. I remember I would avoid it by saying, well, I'm in the theater, you know. I didn't want to explain. As a matter of fact, I still have some of that carried with me. I know sometimes on plane when all of us are together and somebody will be very curious about what we do, and I very often found somebody sitting next to me and saying, well, I'm very curious. What is it you do? So we have a joke amongst us. We say, oh, well, we're funeral directors and we're going to a conference. And, you know, this shuts them up very fast.
Well, you took a break from your dancing career to be in the Army during the Second World War.
I was invited by the government.
Right. Yeah. So now there's a few places more macho than the Army. How did you deal with it then?
Well, you know, I had a choice because the doctors discovered I had a heart murmur, which wasn't serious, but they said I could stay out. But I thought, no, I wanted to go in. I wanted to find out, you know, what the hell this machismo business was and did I fit into the scheme. And I discovered I held myself up very well in terms of bravery, substance, and, you know, moral kind of behaviorism and all that sort of thing very well.
So that helped you overcome
that feeling? It helped me very much. Oh, yes. I didn't worry about that anymore.
When you started to put together what became your own company when you were at the Henry Street Theater in New York, was it hard to find dancers who were interested in modern dance and especially in your vision of modern dance?
No, because it was an indigenous art to the United States, and it had begun to take hold, and people came to it. And we didn't have the fantastic urge and sort of elitist focus towards ballet that we now have. And so although we were homespun, we were damn good. And it's very interesting because European countries recognize that, and before long we were invited to perform in Europe, and we very highly respected in Europe. Now, of course, I mean, they see Giselle Swan Lake very easily there and have, you know, for generations and so forth. So it was a great relief to see modern dance. And so we became a very strongly wanted export product. Still are.
Did you realize pretty early on that it was going to be your calling to be a choreographer? As opposed to a dancer, because it's really as a choreographer, yes, not as a dancer, that you really
not so name. Early on. But I must say, there was one teacher I had, Louis Horst. He was Martha Graham's music director, but he taught choreography, and oh God, he was hellish to study with because he was so absolutely strict, and he didn't like men very much, and his tongue was vitriolic, and you got it right and left. And if you could stand him, however, then you emerged, you know, out of the drop forgery of the art, because he was so perceptive of your skill in motivation, which then took place in motional form through your skill. And he would call even on the finger lifting, on the eighth measure and beat three, he would say, "Why did you do this?" And I discovered I could do this. And when I found out through him that I had the capabilities, then and there I decided I was going to be a choreographer.
Dancers and choreographers are so aware of their bodies and attuned to it and have such beautiful bodies. I'm wondering if getting older and the changes that age brings to the body have affected you more than you think they affect the average person. I don't mean that you're aging quickly, opposite,
yes,
of that, but that you'd be more... feel worse about losing some of the suppleness of the body because
you had
such a good one.
It's, as I got older, I discovered, I developed a skill of verbalization and in directing. And so I do this very well now. So I make token gestures, really, when I choreograph, but my dancers pick it up very quickly. I think one of the most remarkable examples is Murray Lewis, who at 61 now is still one of the greatest virtuoso dancers of our time, in modern dance particularly. I don't think there's any doubt about it. But exquisite detail, my gosh. And he has these stunning dancers in his company that athletically bound and seem to be able to levitate, and yet Murray comes out and with his artistry can immediately command the audience's attention entirely away from them. It's incredible. So I think one, as a performer, gets richer. And modern dance allows that. You see, ballet doesn't. You always have to be a prince or a princess. I know there's a crazy story Murray tells when he was doing some things for Rudolf Nureyev, and Rudolf was concerned about this, he can swear wonderfully. He was in his dressing room pounding, and Murray said to him, "Well, Rudolph, you have to learn now to dance like a man rather than a boy." And see, ballet almost always demands that you must dance as a boy. Modern dance doesn't make that demand. You can dance as a man or a woman.
That's a really interesting distinction.
Yes, yeah, it's wonderful. And we often thought, my God, if you took, Dame Margot, for example, and she still moves beautifully, but she cannot do those athletic young princess roles anymore, but she, choreographed by a modern dancer, she could still be wonderfully beautiful.
Well, I remember Merce Cunningham telling me that as he got older, he started choreographing more things that used his arms. because he didn't require the kind of athleticism that,
yes,
he thought he wouldn't be able to do. Your company and the Murray Lewis Company are collaborating now, and your dancers are performing his works, and his dancers are performing your works.
Yes.
Do you think you're all learning a lot about each,
yes,
other by this trade-off?
Yes, I think we are. And also, Murray's company is eager to work with me, and my company eager to work with Murray's, because... Murray's attack is entirely kinetic, and mine is strongly visual. But both of us demand things that are slightly different, and they want to be to be challenged that way. And they're doing very well. They're doing very well with it.
For years, since the 50s, you've traveled around the United States at least once a year with your company.
Oh, often. More often sometimes, yes.
Just briefly, what's the equivalent of badly tuned pianos? In other words, when a pianist travels, he has to or she has to cope with a badly tuned piano. What does a dancer have to cope with when, or what do you have to cope with the lights and sound too when you're traveling around the country?
Well, the things that are uncomfortable to dancers are bad floor, number one, temperature. I think those are the two things that make their life difficult. And food. So you have to be careful that these are three items that are well taken care of.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so let me ask you this quickly.
Okay.
You have the reputation of being an excellent cook.
That's for therapy.
This is the worst kind of temptation a dancer would want around. Dancers like to eat very little and keep very trim. You must drive your dancers crazy with the dishes you prepare.
No, because I think most of them are good cooks, because we were all very poor at one time, and so you have to learn, if you like food, to prepare that which you like. And it becomes now, for me, a therapy. You can only do one thing when you cook, and that is cook.
Elwin Nicolai, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Elwin Nicolai's Dance Theater will begin a major European tour next week. I'm Terry Grossin. This is Fresh Air.